Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. To the talky bit, love for more than the weekend. So this is not a question to answer out loud, and I think probably deeply rhetorical for most of us, but does anybody else feel like either you're more anxious than you've maybe ever been before, or at least than you normally are, or if that's not the case, that you're surrounded by more anxious people than you've ever been? I said, Karina and I were talking about sort of mental health as a big paradigm the other day, and I kind of mused out loud that I don't know if it's about awareness or circumstance or this intersection. Like, do we just know more about our mental health so we notice it more, or is this actually more pervasive? And this was sort of on the heels of a interview I heard with somebody who's been doing research on ice cores measuring lead levels throughout human history. And they can locate these chronologically inside the cores. And in particular, they were intrigued to know what the lead levels were during the Roman Empire, because they had extensive mining and smelting operations in some parts of Europe. And they used lead in everything, including as a sweetener. Do you like a little lead in that cappuccino? And to such a degree that the numbers that they came up with suggested that the levels of lead in the general population, so this is not the miners, this is just everybody in the empire, would have been sufficient to lower the IQ of the general population by 2 or 3 points. And so the interviewer, Bob McDonald, said, do you think, like, does that play into, it's a bit of a paraphrase here for the question, but does that play into the decline of the empire? And the scientist was very scientific. He's like, I'm going to leave that to my colleagues who study those things. But he did speculate out loud that if you lowered the IQ of your whole population by 2 or 3 points, you know, there might be some outcomes, right, that were discernible in terms of how you governed and what sort of decisions you made militarily and fiscally and so on. So I thought that was interesting as regards sort of the conversation that Karina and I were having and that I was thinking about as far as mental health in our time. And of course, there are lots of thinkers kind of going, yes, there are these environmental factors as well as social factors and so on. So it's an interesting, at a distance, it's interesting. Up close, it's quite distressing. When I think about that, either I'm more anxious or I'm surrounded by more anxious people, for me, it's more the second than the first. I don't feel necessarily personally much more anxious, but I do certainly feel more surrounded by that environment. I certainly don't feel immune to the currents that are carrying the things that seem to be making us anxious these days. That said, every once in a while I have experiences that remind me that the news often doesn't represent anything even remotely resembling our everyday lives. And I think that's an important thing to note. Our everyday lives are mostly pretty mundane. Maybe I shouldn't speak for anyone else. But mine is not necessarily a bad thing, unless we believe that a good life is one that's filled with nonstop variety and distraction, in which case, you know, the mundane could be distressing in itself, right? Because it's not what we want. But that belief, that a good life is one that's filled with variety and distraction, that's a choice, like all of our beliefs. We don't have to believe that. We might have to parse some things a bit to not believe it, but we don't have to choose that. If we think about how we spend the actual minutes and hours of our days, and some of us have done this as an exercise in various contexts where we've actually, for a day or a week, we've actually kind of journaled the course of the use of our time, an interesting and sometimes alarming but always informative exercise. But if we do an exercise like that, what we mostly come away with is the realization that our days are primarily comprised of ordinary things, of work, of eating, of sleeping, of relating to and caring for other people, running errands, paying the bills, trying to get through the day, perhaps the night as well. And sometimes, in the midst of all of that ordinariness, which I think is a thing to celebrate often, that we don't mark, but in the midst of all that ordinariness, sometimes there's a bit of a jolt, a bit of a snap, a bit of a lurch in the system. And when it's a good jolt, it's not unusual for it to have something to do with what we might call love, sort of writ large. So not necessarily romance. This is bigger than love on the weekend. Sometimes the jolt takes us by surprise. And I've had a couple of experiences this past week and a half or so for me that were like that, that kind of maybe helped to bring this to the fore for me. We had the opportunity, Corinne and Taya and I, to spend a couple of days in the mountains, hiking in the mountains near around, and around Canmore, sort of, and into that glorious range that kind of runs right through there over the holidays. And one of those hikes took us into some terrain where we didn't see any other people for much of the day, which is usually a clue about conditions, by the way, if you're... anyway. But on the way back out later in the day, we covered some trail that had a few more users on it. And mostly they were folks that were heading out for a shorter hike than the one that we'd done. They were going up while we were coming down. It was New Year's Day. And I think I can honestly report, I don't think this is hyperbole, because it was so striking to me that I kind of kept track of it in the back of my head. I think I can honestly report that every single person we met, some of whom were working very hard on steep uphills, and all of whom were complete strangers, spared the energy for a smile and a Happy New Year. Why? Like, there's just nothing requisite about that. It's a choice. Completely optional. And for some reason, I don't feel, and I realize there's a choice in this too, but I don't feel as though social convention quite covers that. At least not under the circumstances in which it took place. Now, that's not something I offer as proof so much as a report of an interesting and, for me at least, an encouraging experience. The second experience perhaps shouldn't have taken me by surprise, but it did. I had stopped to pay a visit to a dear friend of ours whose health is in serious decline, someone who, from any sort of reasonable vantage point, may not be with us much longer, although he seems to be full of surprises in this regard. We had a lovely time together. He gathered up his energy to think and speak with me about how poetry and music can give shape to our inner and our outer lives, and about how mysterious it is, how these things sometimes come to us, something he knows something about because he is, among other things, a poet. And when I was saying goodbye, this time it's not a surprise, when I was saying goodbye, I kissed him on the forehead. I told him that I loved him. He said he loved me. I left him to his lunch and his nap, and I went back to my work. But on the way out the door of his room, it hit me like an emotional truck. Love, or at least the thing that I use that language to represent in this story, that was the thing that binds him and I together. And it's what connects us now, and it's what will, I believe, still connect us after one or both of us isn't here to share in-person conversations like that with one another anymore. It's a pretty hard thing to define, isn't it? Love. But it's real. It's powerful. I think it might be as good a way as we have of describing what we use the language of the divine for. And I don't think it's getting the attention that it needs these days. So in the interest of offering, among other things, a bit of a palate cleanser from sort of all the bitter dregs of small-mindedness and runaway self-serving and the waves of tragedy that ripple out from that and occupy so much public space these days, I want to offer a couple of thoughts about love as part of this sort of first talky bit of 2025. Much of the wisdom that underpins these musings is not mine. It's from the minds and lives of people who have dedicated themselves to the nurturance and practice of love, to making it about action, people that I've turned to in my own search to understand this and grow in my understanding of it, and I'm pleased to share their wisdom with you. In his book, A Path with Heart, a mindfulness master, Jack Kornfield, sets the scene this way. He says, "The longing for love and the movement of love is underneath all of our activities." I'll read it again. the longing for love and the movement of love is underneath all of our activities. So I think we need to stop right there for a moment, because all is a superlative. All of our activities? Like, really, Jack? Because some of our activities as human beings sure don't seem to be about love. In that regard, I think the important word in the sentence is the word longing. Let me come back to it. The longing for love and the movement of love is underneath all our activities. As human beings, we will do a lot of things to try to get what we're longing for. And not all of what we do will seem to be consistent with what the longing is about. You ever found yourself just really losing your, you know, on someone that you care about? Someone that you know cares about you, and then you look back on it later and think, well, what was up with me behaving in a way that was pretty much the opposite of what I was longing for, or what I was trying to accomplish relationally? Perhaps I was longing for connection, but I said and did things that would send any rational person running in the opposite direction, right? So unmet, powerful longings and needs often underpin strong actions. We will, ironically, kill for love. I would say that, in my experience at least, there are a few places where this irony shows up more starkly and sort of writ large than in the history of movements that have proclaimed to be about love, but whose actions have been hateful and destructive. And religions, of course, of all stripes have this as part of their stories. They've taught about love and not lived it. And for many people, including many of us in this room, I would say, this has been a powerful factor in our own reexamination of what we believe. That inconsistency has said to us, something is wrong with this story. I can't attribute this quote because it just sort of zipped across my screen as part of something else I was reading, but this is a contemporary social observer by discipline as well as by interest. This person, this is what they study. The quote, paraphrased, is something like, if healthcare is in crisis and healthcare companies are making record profits, if finances are in crisis and banks are making record profits, and there was a third example, something about consumption and production, and the producers are making record profits, the companies are making record profits, then the companies are in crisis. Right? So just flip it around. It's an interesting perspective, and I think akin to this in some ways, saying one thing and living another. For many people, that kind of dissonance causes us to re-examine what we believe or what we say we believe. Go, I don't think I want to play ball if that's the way the game gets played. I'm going to take my ball and go home. Cornfield again says this, all spiritual teachings are in vain if we cannot love. I mean, we could just park on that one, right? But he goes on, even the most exalted states and the most exceptional spiritual accomplishments are unimportant if we cannot be happy in the most basic and ordinary ways, if with our hearts we cannot touch one another and the life we have been given. What matters is how we love. It's no coincidence that the bias to action is so easy to hear in that last sentence. Cornfield does not write, what matters is what we say we believe. He writes, what matters is how we love. It's a call to action. And I know I've mentioned this quote before, but I'm going to mention it again because every time I read it, I'm struck by both what I would call its essential truth and by the feeling I get that it was prescient, that it was farsighted. So this is Bell Hooks, someone whose thinking and writing I enjoy, writing in 2001. So with that in mind, a culture that is dead to love can only be resurrected by spiritual awakening. On the surface, and she's writing as an American citizen, on the surface it appears that our nation has gone so far down the road of secular individualism, worshiping the twin gods of money and power, that there seems to be no place for spiritual life. The crisis, and here's sort of a balancing idea, the crisis in American life does not seem to be generated by lack of interest in spirituality. So this is where religion misbehaves, right here at this intersection, so keep listening. However, this interest in spirituality is constantly co-opted by the powerful forces of materialism and hedonistic consumerism. This is why we encounter religious institutions behaving an awful lot like corporations, right? That's what Hooks is gesturing toward here. So to be clear, Hooks is not contending here for a religious revival, all right? We'd have to dig deeper into the part of her work where she unpacks this to get the nuances of it. But what she's arguing for is the importance of something that may or may not include religion, but it certainly isn't bound or constrained by religion. So love might show up in religion, but we don't have to have religion to act lovingly, would be another way to say it, right? Writing in the mid-50s, psychoanalyst Eric Fromm says this. He says, our society is run, this is fairly strong, our society is run by managerial bureaucracy. Anyone who's ever tried to get a permit through, anyway. Run by managerial bureaucracy, by professional politicians. People are motivated by mass suggestion. Their aim is producing more and consuming more as purposes in themselves. And so Fromm isn't saying that making things or buying things is what kills the spirit and makes love more difficult. He is saying that treating those things as purposes in themselves, as enough, if you will kill the spirit. It will kill love. Art's so utterly subjective. So I'm not commending this person's art to you as something that should appeal to everyone. I have artists as kids. I know better than to do that. But it's striking. Barbara Kruger. Kruger has been working with variations on these kind of themes for decades. Often sort of her work is sort of most notable when she does big public installations, which she is fond of doing and does to good effect. One of them, the piece itself was called Shopping, and what she did is she wrapped a, it's really, when you see photographs of it, it's quite striking. She wrapped a huge multi-story department store in Frankfurt, like several stories of it on two sides, with this enormous mural, a pair of murals that bore in German the words, you want it, period, you buy it, period, you forget it, period. Wrapped around this gigantic department store. It's like, right? As just right in the middle of town. Somebody gave her permission. You don't do that overnight. But interesting stuff. 2005 Venice Biennale, she covered the Italian pavilion with a vinyl mural that included the words, admit nothing, blame everyone. When I ran across that one in her work, I was like, I think some people might have seen that and mistook it as a directive, not as a critique. Anyway. One of her most famous works proclaims, not in an affirming way, I shop, therefore I am. It's a big hand with like a business card in it that says, I shop, therefore I am. And it's clear enough in the broad strokes of the piece that it's a human identifying this way. Here's my card. This is how I define myself as a piece of art. Once again, the critique is not buying what we need. It's buying to satisfy the unmet longings that are deepest within us, the sorts of things we would use the language of love for. It's an attempt to help us consider the possibility that mass consumerism has taken over what we might call, what Fromm calls mass consciousness, when he talks about people responding to mass suggestion, making people think that we are what we possess. I don't like the way I wrote that sentence, making people think that we are what we possess. Who's responsible for what I think again? Oh, yeah. Me. Dang. We might even observe that there seems to be an inverse relationship between the desire to possess and the sense of spiritual emptiness. Because we're spiritually empty, we try to fill up the emptiness. And consumerism is handy. It's everywhere. It's right there. Hooks again. This is so pithy. I feel like I want to have this posted somewhere in my space. I should do that. We may not have enough love, but we can always shop. Like that kind of boils it down, doesn't it? Now, for those of us who grew up around Christianity, and many of us did, some thoughts about this spirit language and spirituality language. In the world of Christian ideas, the spirit is a character, right? It's a personification, if a rather ephemeral one, of the divine. So that's a particular shape. But there's nothing universal about that. It's a particular notion with a visible history in human thought. It has a beginning point in history as an idea, all probability, and end or change point as well. It's been interpreted many different ways along the way. With that in view, I want to point us to a couple of thinkers within that tradition who strike me as understanding this when they spoke about the connection between love and spirit. And these are fairly well-known folks. So I'm going to start with Martin Luther King Jr. This is from a collection of his sermons. The collection is entitled Strength to Love. And in that collection, he describes love as, quote, a spiritual force that unites and binds all life. He doesn't even stop at humans in that definition. He's like, if it's alive, it's connected to the other things that are alive. And the thing, the language that we use for what connects all of these things that are alive is love. So back to Cornfield's idea. What's underneath everything that we do, the movement, the energy that's underneath all the movement is love. So when King unpacks that, he writes this. He says, when I speak of love, I'm not speaking of some sentimental and weak response. I'm speaking of a force which all the great religions have seen as the supreme unifying principle of life. Love is somehow, and I personally appreciate that he doesn't claim to know exactly how, love is somehow the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality. He goes on to describe love as, quote, a Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist belief about ultimate reality, which is interesting, kind of keeps himself in that religious frame. And then he references his own sacred text by quoting the first epistle of John, where it says, let us love one another, for love is God. There's a frequently misunderstood text where we just shift it over to the anthropomorphization of the divine and go, God is loving. It's actually, in fact, not what the pivotal text in that tradition says. It actually says something quite different than that. It says that if you encounter love, you encounter the divine. God is love. Not the same thing. Right? So the anthropomorphization is a particular characterization of love, not the other way around. Significant. Christian mystic John Merton. I've liked Merton better and better as I've gone along. Not least of all because in the late years of his life, he had an affair with his nurse. Now, that might seem like an odd reason to like someone more and more. I don't know. It's not, in my, to be clear, it's not an attempt at justifying any particular behavior of mine, but I love the way he kind of handled it and the way he interpreted it. I'm not going to unpack that in this context, but for him, in the end, when he stood back from it, he realized he needed to kind of do a couple of things. One is he needed to acknowledge to the brothers with whom he held a vow of celibacy that he'd not kept that vow. Fair enough. But also, in the end, he was like, when I stand back from this, this is what it's about. It's actually about love and connection. Now, I behaved outside of my vows, and I need to take responsibility for that. But the current underneath, I'm unapologetic about. So interesting, right? Again, this the longing has so much power that the behavior, our attempt to get closer to that, won't always take us to places that align with our declared values, in the case of Merton, our chosen values, right? But that doesn't make the thing that we were reaching for. That doesn't need to sully the thing we were reaching for. In fact, it's important that it doesn't. He says this about love. Love is, in fact, and so listen to this with the little anecdote that I just talked about in mind. Love is, in fact, an intensification of life, a completeness, a fullness, a wholeness of life. Life curves upward to a peak of intensity, a high point of value and meaning, at which all of its latent creative possibility goes into action, and the person transcends himself or herself, not abstractly, so listen to this, transcends himself or herself in encounter, response, and communion with another. Merton wrote this before he had an affair with his nurse. But think about this in terms of human sexual intimacy for a moment, if you will. We become fully human when we give ourselves, he says, to each other in love. Encounter, response, and communion. That's intriguing. And it makes the anecdote, to me at least, less surprising. It's not actually inconsistent with the vows except in their detail in many ways, right? That seems to me, like, which doesn't, by the way, doesn't diminish the need for him to acknowledge that he stepped outside of what he had declared as his values to those with whom he had them in common. That is also connection and communion and response. That seems to me like another place where it might be good to stop for a moment. This sentence that he closes that quote with. We do not become fully human until we give ourselves to each other in love. What happens if we take an idea like that and we turn it around and we use it as a lens for examining behavior that seems to be something other than the best of what we might mean by being fully human, right? The language that Merton uses, we don't become fully human. What if we kind of reverse it and use it as a criteria? So when we see behavior that's less than fully human, however we understand that, there's lots of subjectivity in here, whether that behavior is in ourselves or it's in another person, do we not also often see that we or they are retreating from giving ourselves to others in love? So when we see bad behavior, don't we also often see retreat from that connection? If we take a good, honest look, might we not see the evidence of retreat, the ways in which we or someone else has turned aside from or even assailed what Merton calls encounter, response, and communion with another? An important side note, at least important to me, some of us have been trained in ways that mean that this kind of self-examination ends up pointing us straight towards shame and self-condemnation. Not the point at all. Taking responsibility for our actions is the path toward freedom from being enslaved by our own choices. I've got a quote. I can't say it for you in Latin, but the English translation is, a man is a slave to whatever he cannot do without. That's that same idea, right? That taking accountability for our choices and actions is actually the path to empowerment and liberation, to freedom. It doesn't need to be about going, what a worm am I, to quote a hymn. Let's think about this for a moment in sort of really grounded, practical terms, because I know I don't spend enough time there. When we see bad behavior, what happens, ours or somebody else's, what happens, let's take ourselves, what happens if we look at ourselves and we ask something like, where in this behavior of mine do I see evidence of encounter, response, or communion with someone else? If I could measure encounter, response, and communion, if they had gauges, and I look at my own behavior and I ask myself, where's the gauge in this behavior of mine? Where's the gauge for encounter? Or if it's a valence, if it's an orientation, what's the compass pointing toward? Is it pointing toward encounter? Is it pointing toward response, especially the mutuality of response? Is it pointing toward communion, which is actually even deeper than response? Response is still you and me. Communion is us. Where's it pointing? Where's my behavior pointing? Feels like a thing that actually makes sense in my head. I don't know if it does in yours. Whatever we call it, soul, God, beloved, higher consciousness, higher power, in many practices, something that cannot be named because that assails the mystery, however we approach this, despite the overwhelming pressures that are around us to conform to all sorts of loveless and insufficient substitutes for the real thing, we still seek to know love and to know it in the kind of mysterious fullness that we might call spiritual. And I love how Cornfield brings us back to earth with that, by saying it doesn't matter how exalted your experience is, it doesn't matter how highly regarded you are as a spiritual person, if you can't love other people and invite other people to love you in ways that help us to be happy in our ordinariness, that's not the thing that is actually the spirituality of love. It's a facsimile. It's a fake. It doesn't mean it won't accomplish anything good, but it's not the thing. My YouTube feed also thinks that I must want to know what is happening in one of the world's most famous rally races, the Dakar, which is underway right now in the deserts of Saudi Arabia. I don't even know how that happened, but anyway, the algorithm's partly right. I'm sort of fascinated why anyone would want to do something like this, because it's quite brutal. But the big takeaway for me from that feed, which I admit to having watched some minutes of, the big takeaway for me has been that in order to win this thing, the core skill is to avoid taking a wrong turn. Everybody's fast. Everybody's at the top of the game. You don't get into the race unless you're one of the best in the world and you don't have the best team and the best technology. Everybody's got great tools. Everyone faces the risk of breaking down, but the biggest variable seems to be route finding. People do take a wrong turn, and you take a wrong turn, and you move from first to 20th in a day. Like, it just kind of really makes a mess of your chances. So this is so important that people even strategically slow down when they're in the lead, because whoever wins that stage starts the next stage first, so that they won't be the first one out of the gate in the morning. So they'll have somebody's tracks to follow. which is a great idea as long as the person in front of you doesn't screw it up. But there's these great drone shots of like six race cars kind of running around like if you tossed a rock into an anthill. They're just kind of going, like buzzing around in the desert trying to figure out where the trail is because the person in the front went the wrong way. We're kind of trained by our surrounding culture to follow the leader. And I think there's a way in which even if you could strip culture away from human experience, which of course we can't, but if we just sort of did it as a mind exercise, I think there would still be something about being human that makes us want to follow and not lead. Leading is risky. Taking responsibility for our own choices is an inherent dilemma, especially if we're conscious of it, because then if we screw it up, who do you blame? Right? It's really hard to hand it off. And so I think there's lots of reasons why we might want to follow rather than lead. And also, we're surrounded by the values of runaway capitalism. And I think the word runaway is important to me in that sentence. This isn't an anti-capitalist screed. But we're so surrounded by those values that it's easy to mistake the winners in the race of life for the people who have the most wealth or stuff. But if we follow that lead, it's incredibly easy to take a wrong turn. Because what we hear over and over again from those who have poured their lives into making the world a better place for all, not just for some, is that the path to that is actually love, not consumption. The path to that is actually encounter, response, and communion. Not wealth, not power, not possessions. Love. I think some of the most remarkable people I've had occasion to meet in my life, and this would be a short list, but there is a list for me, a conscious list, are people who have both great wealth and great love. When I watch some of those people, some of whom I know reasonably well, wrestle with balancing this in their lives, and in many cases doing it well, I find what I'm watching kind of staggering. It's enormously difficult, as far as I can tell, to do that. And I mean, I shouldn't distance myself from this too much, should I? Because by any global standard, I'm also the person with great wealth. Do I also have great love? Do I exercise the power that comes with my wealth on behalf of love? Not what Mayer's describing, which he talks about love in that particular song that I've been so hard on, as a weekend serotonin overload from which he needs to come back down on Monday. Again, not a bad thing to have a weekend of serotonin overload, but if that's what you're after, then you're just putting up with the rest of the week. I'm not sure we're talking about the same thing when we use the word love here. Love that goes deep into the realms of what I've been calling spiritual is love that goes into the realms where we feel filled up, we feel whole, we feel more fully human. But, and I think this is important, so I'll just leave it as the punctuation here, we feel those things and experience those things not as isolated individuals, but as those who are willing to do the things in and with our lives that lead us deeper into encounter, response to, and communion with others. That's where that happens. And it's not going to look the same for any of us, is it? It's going to look quite different. And yet, I think if we stand back from those things when we see them, we also recognize those themes. We can identify those themes. We can say, huh, that moves toward this. When we think about the social justice movement that King was such an instrumental figure in, and in the context for those writings that I quoted, that's not a serotonin overload kind of love. That's pretty heavy lifting, actually. But it is about encounter, it is about response, and it is about communion. I think those are good guiding values. I'm going to leave it there and say peace, let's go. Let's go practice.